Session number 22676, Reel 1.
Major Hutton, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Matfield, Kent.
Which year was this?
1927.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Kent?
No, my father was he just left the Navy at an early age to go on the emergency reserve, and we moved, when he moved his job to London, we lived in Weybridge, but I was at school, privately educated until the age of 9, when we went to live in Cornwall, and then I was at preparatory school near Swanage, the old Malthouse, and then I was at Marlborough.
So is there any one place which you consider to be your home area?
A long time ago now, but Cornwall, where we were brought up, where I lived for 15 years of my childhood.
Whereabouts in Cornwall?
It was on the edge of Bodmin Moor, just outside a village called St. Bruid, out in the wilds.
Have you any memories from the Second World War?
Oh, very poignant. I remember the Second World War extremely well because I was 12 when it started and took a great interest in everything that was going on. But my father rejoined the Navy on the Munich crisis when the Navy recalled the emergency reserve. And so we were very much following what he was doing. But sadly, he went out to the Mediterranean in 1941 and he lost his life during the evacuation of Greece, when his small craft was sunk with all hands.
And do you know the name of the craft?
It was an A1 lighter, which was a tank landing craft. He commanded a flotilla of these, which were supporting Wavell in his advance across the towards Tobruk to Benghazi, which I think the first thrust got to. So my father landed tanks at Tobruk to support this, but as is well known historically, the troops from Wavell's army had to be sent in large part to assist the Greeks when the Germans invaded in the spring of 1941. And as is well known, of course, this was a disaster, and we had to evacuate under very trying conditions of airstrikes and so on. And there's this stage that my father lost his life and has never been heard of again. They were posted as missing for just over 3 years, and so my mother had obviously a very difficult time not knowing anything about him and whether his will could be executed, which it couldn't be until you're missing, presumed killed. And this came through eventually when we reoccupied the Greek islands in the late 1941, and it was known then that any people who had perhaps been in hiding for the course of the war would not turn up.
Possibly in late 1944, I think, maybe.
I meant 44, yes, I'm sorry.
What rank did he have?
He was an acting commander, Royal Navy.
And did the war, apart from that, did the war directly affect you?
No, not at all, not in any way other than that affected anybody else who was living in the country at the time. It affected me, of course, in that we all had to go straight into the services from school. We couldn't immediately pursue a university education or go straight into a career. We had to join the army for an unlimited spell until it was known when the duration of the emergency would conclude.
Did you experience any bombing by the German Air Force?
Not down in Cornwall. That isn't strictly true. A couple of nuisance aircraft, Focke-Wulf 190s, flew over our house, swung left and dropped two bombs on the village of St. Bruid. I think that was in 1943. So we had no experience of bombing there, nor did we at my school.
What effect did these bombs on St. Bruid have?
They did some damage to the granite quarry, and they demolished the Wesleyan Chapel up in the village and killed a small boy.
Did you know him?
Not personally.
Any celebrations you remember at the end of the war?
Well, at the end of the war, on VE Day, I just joined the Rifle Brigade as a private soldier at Winchester. In fact, I joined the army May the 2nd, 45, and VE Day was 6 days later. So, of course, we had the day off, and there were tremendous celebrations in Winchester, which, of course, was an army town. It had two sets of barracks and so on and so forth. And I remember that quite well.
Why did you go in for the army?
I think my father had hoped that I'd follow him into the Navy, but unfortunately I wouldn't have been able to pass the colour test for the Navy, for the executive branch of the Navy, which they're very strict on. And so I decided I wouldn't try for any other branch of the Navy. So I joined the army, which certainly my mother's mother was very keen that I should do, because my grandfather on my mother's side had been a long-serving soldier in the Middlesex Regiment.
So you were colourblind?
Pale red and pale green, which is rather important when lights are coming to pass you at sea. But the army, I think strictly speaking, the army shouldn't take one for teeth arms with red-green colourblind, I don't think they considered I was serious enough, so I had no problem. I had no problem being accepted for teeth arms, for a commission anyway.
Did you particularly want the Rifle Brigade?
The reason I went with the Rifle Brigade was because recruiting team from the Green Jackets, the Rifle Brigade and the 6th Rifles, were touring the public schools to try and pick off the public school boys they wanted as they would have liked as officers. And of course they took far more than they needed for regular commissions, so a lot of us were commissioned into the Rifle Brigade with emergency wartime commissions, which I was in May 1946, and I in fact spent only a year with them, and I realised that competition was a bit too fierce to get a regular commission in the Rifle Brigade, so I transferred to my county regiment, the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry. I served in Rhine Army with the 1st Battalion Rifle Brigade from late 1946 through a lot of 1947. When I transferred to the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, I was posted out to their 1st Battalion in Cyprus, where they had the unenviable job of guarding all the illegal Jewish immigrants who had been attempting to get into Palestine and had been stopped by the Royal Navy. The well-known story, I think. There have been films about it and goodness knows what. These ships were all offloaded at Famagusta, and the Jewish immigrants were put in, who were from all over Europe and some of them from North Africa, were put into heavily guarded compounds, and the most we ever had in those compounds were 32,000. So it was a very major operation for the army at that time to guard these people, because they had to be kept confined. They weren't allowed out into the island at all, except under armed escort.
Where was your camp?
It was at Decalia, which was on the coast of Cyprus, about 8 miles east of Larnaca. And the biggest camp of Jews was with Jews in it was called Zelotenbu.
What conditions were they living under?
They were perfectly comfortable. They had Nissen huts and quite a lot in tents when there were too many for hutted accommodation. And they had better food than the British Army. This is always rather a point of complaint with the soldiers guarding them, that they had British Army rations, and on top of that they had American aid food. So in fact, in a way, the only discomfort they had was that they were confined.
What did American aid food consist of?
I don't know exactly what it was, but it was a very welcome supplement to British Army rations.
How did the Jewish emigres behave?
well, they pay perfectly well. There were occasionally protests when crowds would assemble on inside the Wharf and start shouting and throwing things and so on and so forth. But these incidents were very rare, and in fact, they just. I think it's true to say that the European Jews at that time were, shall we say, sadly used to confinement. Of course, we were treating them a great deal better than they had been in the German occupied part of Europe, so they behaved quite docilely and just waited for their eventual release. They were allowed in at the rate of 600 a month, as we had at the time the mandate for Palestine, and the rules we set were we would accept 600 immigrants a month. And these gradually filtered out, but of course in June 48, when the State of Israel was born and the British Mandate of Palestine concluded, they were all had to be released and were shipped over en masse into Palestine.
What were the occasional protests about?
Oh, I think that simply the conditions and the fact that they were confined. To them, their confinement was illegal, because they were those camps were, in a way, they were concentration camps. There was a very high wire, probably about the height of this room, 12 foot or so, and there was a catwalk between the barbed wire fences. Real sort of confinement situation. Sentry towers every couple of hundred yards with an armed sentry, and all the time, searchlights to beam along the catwalk to look for anybody attempting to escape, and so on and so forth. So they were pretty rigid. It was a pretty rigid situation of confinement.
Did any of them try to get out?
I think there were very occasional attempts to escape, but of course we were entitled to shoot if people attempting to escape, provided they didn't halt when challenged. So it wasn't really worth them trying to escape. They had nowhere to go in Cyprus. They would have had to got a boat over to Israel, and they would have been in the guise of fugitives, and they all knew that they'd be allowed into Palestine eventually, so they didn't try and on the whole they didn't try and escape.
Was there any shooting or violence?
I can't recall any serious incident. No, I can't recall any serious incident. I think there may have been the odd shot fired in anger. But I don't know of one single immigrant being killed.
What were relations like between the Jews and the British soldiers?
Well, the British soldier has a knack of getting on well with anybody, so they were on quite sort of chatty terms. But they didn't really have a chance to meet very much. The soldiers who were guarding them and the immigrants inside the Wharf never really met. There were teams who were employed administering the Jews in the camps, and I think they were on perfectly amiable relations on the whole. Of course, there was a language problem, because most of the immigrants spoke German, and the soldiers have very funny ideas of the of the languages they attempt to converse with other nationalities, but they usually get on.
Was it possible to say what the Cypriots thought about the situation?
In those days, we were still in an empirical situation. Cyprus was a crown colony, and they had very little contact or knowledge of what went on. The camps were in a fairly isolated sites. They weren't near towns or villages.
Which battalion were you with?
That was with the 1st Battalion, Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry. There were three battalions doing this job, the South Wales Borders and the King's Regiment.
What were your duties with the battalion?
Mine personally, I was a subaltern in a company, and when we weren't actually in a situation of where the company was on guard duty, when one was responsible for not only administering the troops but running the sentry roosters and so on and so forth. We were back down in the camp with the rest of the battalion, doing the normal sort of duties, training and so on and so forth. And I was doing the job of an ordinary infantry subaltern. In fact, I was appointed weapon training officer because I'd been on a course at Small Arms School at Hythe in Kent.
So are we talking about, as far as you're concerned, 1948?
This was 19. The time I was there was from December 48 to from December 47 to September 48, when the battalion moved to East Africa.
Was your period in Cyprus a good or a bad time?
Oh, very good, because Cyprus was a lovely island. It was quite unspoilt by the tourist situation at the moment. There were no concrete hotels on the seafronts and so on and so forth. Ayia Napa, which is famous now as a tourist resort, was a fishing village. And we had, apart from the fact that, of course, in those days, young army officers were pretty hard up. We couldn't afford to visit the bright lights very often, such as they were. But when we were off duty, we had a marvellous time. And of course, the swimming was superb. The army's always got tremendous sports facilities. So when we weren't on duty, we had a good time.
Then you went to East Africa?
Yes, the battalion was moved to British Somaliland in September 48. An old coal-burning troop ship called the Empire Helford, I think, was called. Came to Farm Augusta, and we were all loaded on it, embarked, and went down the canal, called at Massawa, where we'd sent an advance party to take over from the Royal Berkshire Regiment in Asmara, but the posting situation of battalions was rather fluid at the time, and one was told one was going to one place one week, and then it would all be changed a couple of weeks later. So it was British Somaliland for us, eventually, and we got out of the Red, down through the Red Sea, turned right, and found ourselves outside the port of Berbera. At Berbera, there were no facilities for offloading troops, so the troop ship had to load its lifeboats, and the battalion disembarked on the ship's lifeboats. There was no accommodation to speak of. I think Middle East Command, and I hope I'm not making derogatory remarks about the staff at the time, but they hadn't realised there were no accommodation stores in British Somaliland, and so the battalion arrived with virtually nothing except its G1098 equipment. There were no beds, cupboards, or anything of that sort for cooking equipment. We had to use our own G10, and we managed. The soldiers had to sleep on the floor. If the officers were clever enough to pinch a stretcher or something, then they might have been a little bit more comfortable. But it was enormous fun there, because it was most unusual being posted to a country that was really almost completely empty of anybody except the local population of Somalis, and there weren't all that many of them. There was plenty of game that was really unspoilt by human beings, especially the white man, and they weren't used to being shot. It was rather sad, because in those days there wasn't the feelings about shooting game that there are now. And the first thing we wanted to do was go out and shoot a lesser kudu or even a lion, and the lion was shot by an officer actually out there. But we weren't there very long. We'd been sent there because there was an indigenous regiment called Somaliland Scouts, which were perfectly reputable little unit with British officers. But there'd been a drought, and they had thought there might be fighting between tribes over the water sources and the wells and so on, and that the Somaliland scouts mightn't be reliable because they, being tribal in themselves, they would favour one side rather than the other. They wouldn't be impartial. So we were sent there to, really on for internal security duties in case any such situation arose. But we weren't called upon for any work of that nature. And by January, we were only there 4 months, by January we were ordered to Mogadishu, which was in Somalia. There were two different countries then. British Somaliland was the Somaliland Protectorate in the north, with, of course, French Somaliland, which was really only consisted of the port of Djibouti, further north again. But the biggest part of Somaliland was what had been Italian Somaliland, Somalia, with its capital Mogadishu, on the round the corner of the Horn of Africa. And the move down to Mogadishu was actually quite an interesting one, because they didn't want to send a large troop trip to Berbera to take the battalion just round the Horn to Mogadishu. So half the battalion were put in old Italian diesel lorries, which were the great sort of ships of the desert there, transported everyone everywhere. They were put in these Italian diesel lorries, and they did a 700-mile cross Africa trip over tracks, certainly no tarmac roads, until they got much nearer Mogadishu. And the rest of us, a small troop ship was sent to take the rest of us around to Mogadishu, and I actually was in that party rather than the overland one, which was a pity, because the overland one had the most interesting time. They went actually through the Ogaden, which was part of Ethiopia, and no one was there to stop them. Battalion then arrived in Mogadishu, where there was one other British battalion, the Border Regiment. The reason the British troops were in Somalia rather than the garrison of local troops, which again was British officers, just called Somalia Gendarmerie, was that in early 48, the Italians had rioted in protest the fact that they thought they would be put under Italian jurisdiction again, and they didn't want the Italians back. They wanted independence eventually, of course.
The Somalis rioted.
Somalis, yes. And at an early hour of a Sunday morning in January 48, I think it was, gangs of Somalis broke into Italian houses and massacred 57 Italians, which of course was a very bad publicity for us. And we were the sort of occupying mandatory power, having overrun the country in 1941, so there really was a demand for much stricter internal security and garrison arrangements. So they then posted British troops to Somalia. The Somalia Gendarmerie was disbanded, rather lost its name, because it took no action to prevent what went on. I was rather afraid the officers were recovering from a heavy Saturday night out, so the Somali Gendarmerie was disbanded, and these two British battalions were sent there. There were also two battalions from East Africa. One was the Northern Rhodesia Regiment, which was a place called Ishabadar, and another battalion of the King's African Rifles was up at a place called Bellagio, up country, so to speak. So I personally spent a whole year there. It was, in a way, rather a wasted year, because there wasn't much to do there. It was extremely hot. And there wasn't much for the troops to do either. In a way, it was interesting to have been there in view of what happened to Mogadishu since, and what a lawless place it's become, probably about the most dangerous place in the world, and that's saying a lot at the moment.
Could you, at that time in 1949, have anticipated the disintegration that's occurred since?
I would don't think in any way. I don't think we were aware, because the country was being run in a British colonial way with the district officers and garrison troops and so on and so forth. I don't think we were aware of the intense tribal rivalry there is within the Somalis in general. They're intensely tribal, and in a way rather like Afghanistan, they don't like a central government which is being run by people who are other than their own tribe. So they will try and overthrow it and put their own people in charge. I don't think we were aware of that at that time, that this situation would arise. I didn't follow closely the history of Somalia since independence. They got independence in 1960. It is remembered that when British troops withdrew from there in early 1950, that the Italians were given the mandate for a United Nations mandate for 10 years to prepare them for independence, which they got in 1960. So despite Somali hostility to the Italians coming back, they were granted this mandate, and I think it all went quite smoothly.
What was the Somali attitude towards you and other British people at that time?
We always like to think in our vanity that that immodest vanity, that we get on well with native people, and we got on perfectly well with Somalis. There was one incident where a rata was shot by party of the border regiment to quell a violent demonstration. This was a copybook internal security operation where the notice boards are put up, and if you don't disperse, we fire, and so on. And then one soldier is told to fire one round at a ringleader, and one ringleader was shot dead, and the crowd then dispersed. That was the only incident of that kind during 1949.
Did you witness that?
I personally didn't witness it, no.
What were they writing or demonstrating about?
They were demonstrating against the United Nations resolution for the Italians to come back. The Italians weren't popular there, I'm afraid. They tended to try and settle Somalia and farm the river valleys, but they were also, the Italians there were people who had been really people who were against Mussolini and were sent to Somalia as a form of exile. That's what we were led to believe.
How did your troops like or dislike being in Somalia?
I don't think it wasn't a good station. Somalia is not a good station for British troops. It's very hot. There's very little to do there.
Did you have any discipline problems with them, therefore?
Nothing beyond the normal run of disciplinary problems that a British battalion gets, particularly when they've been out on a Friday or Saturday night.
Were they mostly from Cornwall?
A lot were, but even then the light infantry were swapping troops from their various counties. We had quite a lot from Durham, Yorkshire, and Somerset, as well as Cornishmen. Cornwall, on the whole, never really manned their regiment fully. So many Cornishmen go into the Navy and into the Marines and Royal Artillery and so on and so forth. There aren't enough men of military age in the population of Cornwall to man the two battalions of a regiment, as there were in those days.
Any other memories of being in East Africa?
Well, of course, again, we had our off-duty times were good for people who were prepared to go out in the country, again on shooting expeditions. So one has happy memories of that. There were always a complaint in areas like that with the young is the lack of girlfriends, because after all we're social animals. We were very young men. I was 22 at the time, 21, 22. There were one or two very pretty Italian girls about, but relationships there were not easy, because they were heavily chaperoned for a start, which was always the fun there, is trying to escape the chaperone. Apart from that, I don't remember my time in that whole year in Mogadishu with very fond memories. I was longing.